What is happening right now at this very moment is the Mahakumbh Mela. Can you tell us about that?
So every 12 years you have a Kumbh. Generally it happens, you know, at the confluence of rivers, where there's multiple rivers joining, the Sangam. So Prayagraj, for example, you know, is a Sangam. And where there's water flowing, you know, fresh water flowing. And this happens in a season when winter is going out and, you know, summer is coming in or spring is coming in. And people are encouraged to go out and, you know, take a dip. It is about cleaning. It's about mental, spiritual, physical cleaning. It's also about coming together.
When did the goddesses lose all their power and just the male form of God became so strong?
No, I don't think that ever happened. So you see, the eastern side of the country has always been more into goddess worship. You know, yeah, so you go to Assam, you go to Bengal, Durga Puja is the biggest festival there, right? Yeah. Then in Gujarat, you have Navratri, one of the biggest festivals, you know. So all the big pilgrimages of the Devi are actually in the north.
What happened with Sabarimala? Because that was something that I never understood till the end.
There are temples dedicated to the goddess where men are not allowed of any age.
Okay.
Sabarimala has a restriction of women who are menstruating. Younger children can go, older women can go. But there are temples dedicated to goddess where no man can go, whether a child or an old man.
Why the Agni Pariksha for Sita?
Okay, so that is one of the most misunderstood incidents in the entire Ramayana. Okay, it is Sita's own decision.
Hi everyone, welcome to Sanskriti Radio, where we dive deep into fascinating stories, explore unique perspectives, and engage in meaningful conversations. Today we have the distinct honor of welcoming Dr. Vineet Agarwal to the show. Dr. Agarwal is a multifaceted personality, a medical doctor by profession, an author by passion, and a storyteller at heart. Known for seamlessly blending science, history, and mythology, his work rings ancient Indian wisdom to life in a way that resonates with modern audiences. In this episode, we'll delve into his journey as a doctor turned author, his passion for unraveling the mysteries of India's mythological heritage, answer some basic questions, and remove some misconceptions regarding Hinduism. So sit back, relax, and join us as we embark on this enriching conversation with Dr. Vineet Agarwal.
Thank you for joining us, Vineetji. Namaskar.
My pleasure.
Okay, so before we start with the whole list of questions that I have for you, I would like you to introduce yourself, because I've seen you are a doctor, so this is not just a doctor, a PhD doctor, you are a medicine doctor.
Right. So I've had a very different journey than, you know, most of the doctors that you would find, the medical doctors. So I did my graduation in medicine, and then I actually moved into MBA, okay, which is management studies, and I then joined pharma industry. So I am actually making the best use of both my qualifications in the industry, where I get to use my medical knowledge as well as, you know, use the managerial skills. So okay, that's something. I mean, it's a long journey. I don't want to bore your audience with how it happened, but that's how it happened. And I think since then, I've been traveling around, and I look after a lot of markets in the Southeast Asia region. And while traveling, I got to know, I was rather, you know, reintroduced to my own culture when I realized that, you know, there's so much Indian influence in a lot of countries in Asia. And of course, there's various reasons. There was Indian traders, there was the spread of Buddhism, there's a lot of lot that happened, you know. There was the Rajaraja Chola, you know, one of the Indian kings who spread his empire throughout the islands. So there's multiple reasons, but for some reason in India, we do not know much about it. And, you know, we don't really realize that, you know, there was such a huge Indosphere in our neighborhood that, you know, we haven't been made aware of. And I think that kind of led me to dig in deeper and, you know, okay, try and uncover the truth of our culture, our history, how it came about, you know, who were the founders, who were the, you know, thinkers, who were the kings, who were the, what were the dynasties, etc. And I think I got completely immersed in that, you know, digging it up. And
now you've become now you've become sort of an expert in Sanatan Dharma. So that's not easy.
I wouldn't say, you know, it's very difficult to know everything about Sanatan Dharma because it is so vast. Yeah. And Indian history also, you know, it's huge and it is incomplete. Even today it is incomplete because there's a lot of places that we haven't really explored, we haven't excavated, we haven't dug up. And, you know, everywhere, every day you hear news of, you know, some old temple being found in a place when, mm-hmm. you know, people were digging up for yeah. unrelated stuff. So there's so much to explore. I don't think anyone can become an expert on India or its culture or its religion. It would take multiple lifetimes to do that. But yes, what I have been doing is, you know, whatever I have learned, I try and keep sharing with others so that maybe, you know, it can inspire someone to do much more or get into the research or find more about it and know about their own roots.
So what is the origin of Hinduism or Sanatan Dharma?
So this is a very common question that I get, and you know, and I know where it's coming from, because a lot of people today are acquainted with the Western concept of religion, where there's one founder, you know, there's one personality around which the entire religion revolves. So Sanatan Dharma itself means the eternal religion. We do not believe that there is one human who could have laid foundation to it. It is something which has been always existing, and it has been there in the universe. It is what's guiding the universe. So we're not talking about religion here. We're talking about the principles that run this universe, the principles that govern this universe. And these, the elements that run this universe, the deities are basically the elemental gods. You know, Brahma, Vishnu and Shiva and Shakti, we understand them as, you know, cosmological entities, you know. So Shiva is time, Vishnu is space, and Shakti is energy that is running throughout the universe. So in that sense, we believe it's always been there. It's just been, you know, humans have identified it in different ways. And, you know, we have approached God in different ways. But in Sanatan Dharma, there have been numerous thinkers over hundreds and thousands of years who have, you know, formulated philosophies based on their own experiences. So there are multiple streams that merge into this ocean, which we call Sanatan Dharma. So they cannot be one person, one origin. It is the origin of it's there since the origin of the universe.
You would rather say that Sanatan Dharma is more a lifestyle than a religion?
I would say it is an understanding. It is not just a lifestyle. It's not just about, you know, behaving in a certain way. It's about understanding the universe in a certain way. It's about a philosophy that helps you live in a more cohesive manner in today's world, and which has always guided us, you know, since centuries, since millennia, you know. And that's why, you know, India was at the, you know, top of the world in terms of spiritual achievements for the longest time. And even today, you wouldn't find too many, you know, contenders for that spot, because we've always explored both within us and outside us in a common thread, in sort of a common thread, you know. So the Upanishads talk about the Atman, which is the soul within you, and the Brahman, which is the universe existing outside of you. And both of them are supposed to meet in you. So we are the manifestations of this universe. You know, we are small pieces of this universe manifesting itself. And that is how Sanatan Dharma looks at it. So it's not a religion, I would say. Of course, there's some rituals that we follow today. There's some beliefs that we follow today. But primarily, it's a way of life.
How would you describe the numerous gods and goddesses that we have? Because I have a personal theory that like when colonization happened, when the British arrived, an easy way to colonize people is also to, you know, break their confidence and tell them all that they know is a lie. So that's how they turned all of our history into mythology. So like Ram, Krishna and all of them became mythological creatures. But then apart from that, we have Ganesh and we have other gods and goddesses, you know, which do not look exactly like human beings, let's say, and with superpowers. So how do you explain all this?
Okay, so for a beginner, what I would, you know, how I would go about explaining it is that God is one. Okay,
yeah.
So most world religions agree that God is one, right? The Western religions are primarily based on that concept that, yeah, you know, there is only one God. And a lot of Westerners are, you know, misinformed that Hinduism has multiple gods.
Hmm.
Actually, that is not correct. Hinduism also supports the idea of only one supreme being, the supreme Brahma, the Parabrahma.
Brahman.
The Parabrahma manifests in different forms, though. We do not believe that it's an entity that is outside the universe and not interacting with us in any way, or, you know, it's not like a you know, an old angry person sitting on a throne with a thunderbolt in his hand, ready to
and
smite.
And judging us.
Yeah, so it's that's not our concept of God. We believe God permeates this universe. So for, and God does not have a gender. So he or she, you know, either term is okay. But God manifests in different ways to enable the functioning of this universe. So as Vishnu, he provides the space component, right? The Shiv, Lord Shiv, we call him Mahakal. Kal means time.
Hmm.
Everything that you associate with Lord Shiv is representing time. You know, he has the serpent of time around his neck. He has the moon, which is used to count tithis in the calendar on his forehead. He has a trident, you know. So why try? Why three? Because it is the past, present and future. So there's so many ways, there's so many symbolic ways that the ancients tried to bring the concept of time to us. Similarly, if you see Lord Vishnu, you know, what's his color? He's dark like space. He's blue like sky. So that's the concept. And within his body, if you remember the Bhagavad Gita Virat Roop, within his body exists the 14 lokas. So it's clearly the concept of space in this entire universe. And Shakti is energy, right? Shakti primarily is manifests. It's an energy taking different shapes and different forms. That is why we have goddess in so many forms. You know, we have the Navdurga, we have the Dashmahavidya, we have the Saptamatrika. Goddess has the most forms because energy can only change forms. It can never be destroyed. So those are the concepts, the scientific concepts that are represented through certain deities. And over thousands of years, the rishis, the sages, the seers, they kind of crystallized those depictions into what is more conducive for the person, for a devotee to connect with them.
Mm.
And, you know, so Indra represents, you know, thunder and lightning. You know, there's a god called Parjanya who represents the cloud, rain clouds. There's Agni, that's fire. Varun is, you know, water. Vayu is air. So there's so many elemental deities. These are the, I would say, I mean, the Westerners thought that they were just anthropomorphized forms of our, you know, natural elements that we see. But it's not just that. We recognize that, you know, nothing can work by itself. It is not an insentient world. It runs through intelligence. There's intelligence in everything you see. The way the universe is organized, the way the planets revolve around the stars, the entire formation of, you know, solar systems, etc. Everything has a design, right? Everything has some logic behind it, which we are still trying to figure out, you know, the unified theory of everything sort of that we're trying to get to know. But as we go deeper into quantum physics and atomic structures, etc., we realize everything is so beautifully designed. It cannot be random. And that is the belief in Hinduism, that, you know, all these elements, all these things are governed by deities. So, for example, if we are worshipping the sun, we are not worshipping the star. We are worshipping the deity who's controlling that star. So that is the concept. And that is why we have multiple gods, because we consider that even human beings are parts of God. So, you know, if you have 8 billion humans, You, why can't you have, you know, 33 million
80 billion
gods?
gods.
That's the whole idea. It's everybody, each person, each being has some aspect of God in it. And that's the reason. Otherwise, God is just one.
Yeah.
He or she manifests in different forms.
So we have equal number of goddesses, or maybe more, like you say, because energy changes forms. At what point did India become so masculine? In the way, when did the goddesses lose all their power and just the male form of God became so strong? When did this misconception happen?
No, I don't think that ever happened. Actually, there were always pockets of worship of gods and goddesses. Different, of course, there were some political reasons. Some ruler supported a particular deity. Some king had a personal favorite, etc., etc. So you see, the eastern side of the country has always been more into goddess worship. You know, yeah, so you go to Assam, you go to Bengal. Durga Puja is the biggest festival there, right?
Yeah.
Then in Gujarat, you have Navratri, is one of the biggest festivals. In the north, in Navratri, you see a lot of people fasting, you know. So all the big pilgrimages of the Devi are actually in the north. You know, the Shakti Peeth are scattered all around. But Vaishno Devi, you know, one of the biggest pilgrimage spots for Devi is in the north. In the south, there's, you know, the Sri Vidya tradition, which is very popular. Madurai temple is one of the biggest pilgrimage sites again. So it was never that, you know, gods were more superior or the goddess was superior. There's always been different schools of thought, and each person, each sect has followed their own traditions. And if you mean from a perspective of society, that, you know, how it became more male dominated, that's a different thing. But again, I think there's various reasons for it, and some of them are very clearly historical. They're not related to religion. That, you know, when you have a lot of invasions, when you have a lot of outsiders coming in, it is by far, it is the men who go out to fight. You know, we had women soldiers as well. We had female soldiers as well in our history. But more or less, you know, it's the men who go out to fight. So they get to make some rules, right? Like you see in Padmavat, you know, it's a movie, but it's based on reality, how the Rajput women used to sacrifice their lives instead of, you know, and so there's a lot of historical reasons for that. But religion-wise, I would say it has never been ever dominated by only one deity. It has always been different schools of thought coming together to realize that, you know, there's one supreme being, and each of us worship a different form as supreme.
This is very interesting, because I never thought of it in the term of war and when, how did India become so male dominant at some point, which obviously doesn't date back very far. But then at the same time, what all of us women, I would like to say Indian women, have questions are like, why the Agni Pariksha for Sita, let's say.
Okay, so that is one of the most misunderstood incidents in the entire Ramayana. And a lot of people believe that Ramji asked Sitaji to go to do a Agni Pariksha, right? So that is the general belief. So the Valmiki Ramayana, which is the original story, nowhere does Sri Ram ask Sitaji to prove her chastity. Okay, it is Sita's own decision, because Ram definitely encourages her to do it by making some harsh comments. You know why? Because he says that, you know, as a husband, I perform my duty. You were kidnapped by a asura, and I have, you know, traversed the length and breadth of the country. I've made alliances with people I did not know, with tribes I did not know. And I've, you know, made a bridge over the ocean to come and rescue you. That was my duty as a husband, and I've fulfilled that duty. Now he realizes that when they go back, they will not just be husband and wife. They'll be the king and queen of Ayodhya. And as Ram has proved himself worthy of being a king by defeating a Rakshas like Ravan, you know, who was tormenting the three worlds, there would be an expectation from Sita as well to show her eligibility to be the queen of Ayodhya. But Ram himself never asks her to do it. Ram says that you are free to go wherever you want. I did my duty. That does not bind you to me. You can decide to stay here in Lanka. You can decide to come back to Ayodhya. You wish you can marry anyone else. I do not expect you to come back with me because I rescued you. Imagine this is such a beautiful expression of his faith in her, that he says that he knows she will not go anywhere, but he gives her that freedom. He gives her that choice that you choose where you want to go. But Sita is so offended by that suggestion that she says, how can you even think that I will go anywhere else? And then she orders Lakshman to create a pyre where, you know, she says that I'll end my life. And that is when the gods appear and, you know, Agnidev appears, and the gods tell Ram that, why are you behaving this way? Why are you saying all these harsh words? And Ram says, I'm behaving as a normal human would, you know, as a king would. I have utmost faith in my wife, right? But now she will be the queen of Ayodhya. So there is, you know, it's just sad that in Kali Yuga, we are so used to our leaders being so corrupt and morally, you know, deprived or depraved, I would say, that, you know, we don't understand his intention. That his intention was that a leader, the king and the queen of Ayodhya, of the citizens, should be blemishless, you know. And he himself gave all the tests that were required for that. So, one, he never asked Sita to do that Agni Pariksha. Second, Sita was not, she was not like a, you know, how people say that, ye to guy hai, you know, like she's so docile. She was a headstrong woman. She had her own mind. She could take her own decisions. And that is why she, first of all, in the very instance, coming to the forest was not Ram's choice. Yeah. Sita's coming to the forest. He did not want her to come. He wanted her to stay safe in Ayodhya. It was she who wanted to come. It was she who made him go after the Swarn Mrig. It was she who decided to create, you know, who ordered Lakshman to create a pyre. All these decisions were taken by Sita, not by Ram. So, you know, it's very convenient to blame Ram for everything, but and call it a male chauvinistic society and all that. But when you read the Valmiki Ramayana, you actually understand that, boss, this is a completely different picture, you know, the way it is portrayed.
So all this that you've told us, is there in the Valmiki Ramayana?
Sorry?
All this that you just mentioned, is it there in the Valmiki Ramayana?
Of course, yes. Entire Valmiki Ramayana is so beautifully written. It is a historical text because Valmiki existed at that time. He is a part of that story, right?
Yeah.
So he wrote everything that came to him that he could see in his visions, and everything that he himself experienced or he heard from others. And all those things, he's put them down. And that is the only original version of Ramayana.
So what happened in the Ramcharitmanas then? What went wrong?
No, it is not. It is a devotional interpretation of Valmiki Ramayana. Just like there's so many regional versions, you know, where, you know, there's the Kamba Ramayana, there's the Krithivas Ojha Ramayana, there's hundreds of versions of Ramayana. There's the Thai Ramayana, where actually Hanuman is not a celibate and he has a child with a mermaid. So now, you know, anybody can write any story. Anybody can create diversions in the story and create new plots and subplots. That does not change the original in any way. So I think that is another thing that people should understand, that Valmiki Ramayana is the original. There is no two doubts about it. It's like saying that, you know, J.K. Rowling wrote Harry Potter and now someone else has created a new Harry Potter series with same characters doing the same things differently, and this is equally authentic. How can it be?
Okay.
You know? So the later versions, which were written hundreds and thousands of years later, how can you equate them with the original work? It cannot be.
But isn't that the reason why then history becomes mythology? Because then they are just stories. They just become legends and you don't know what is truth. And
exactly. I think there's a lot of confusion that happens. But, you know, a lot of it also is a result of the changing times. You know, the society has evolved, the values have evolved. So people in different time periods and different regions, they change the story to suit the audience that they were writing for. And that is why, you know, in Bengal, in the Kritibas Ojha version, the Bengali version of the Ramayana, you actually see Sita fighting an even bigger demon than Ravan. You know, when they come back to Ayodhya, there's another demon, Sahasra Ravan, that, you know, emerges. And Ram is unable to defeat him. And it's actually Sita who takes the form of Kali and defeats him. So you clearly see, you know, the story is being told in, for a certain audience. And you know, it's great to have variations. It's great to have different adaptations. But that cannot change the original.
Okay. So my next question, because we're talking about women in Hinduism, comes from the Gita that I have. So in my last class, a girl asked the Gita to read and she read just the first chapter and she comes back to me saying that she found a line which says women are not very intelligent. So then I went back. So it's the 41st shloka of the first chapter where Arjun is talking to Krishna. And this was the interpretation of the person who has translated, basically who's given the commentary. But then he cited the Chanakya Pandita. And apparently the Chanakya Pandita says that women are generally not very intelligent and therefore not trustworthy.
Right. No, I agree. I completely agree. There are statements like that. You know, you can't really shove them under the carpet and, you know, just say that nothing like that existed. But again, I would say it shows how the times changed.
Yeah.
You know, in Chanakya's time, that's when Alexander was invading. Again, you know, you have to go back to history to understand. Again, you know, you find in the Mahabharata also, Bhishma Pitama makes certain comments about women not being so intelligent, etc., etc. Again, people forget, who was Bhishma Pitama? He was a bachelor. He was a lifelong bachelor. He never interacted with women in any capacity, except, of course, his mother. He did not ever interact with women. So he had his own views, he had his own thoughts, just like everyone today does. You know, there are societies, there are people within the same society who have widely different views about, you know, women emancipation and feminism and the various forms it has. So how can you expect people in the ancient times to have a coherent view about it? So there are views like this. Definitely, there are people who have made those statements. But I would say it is not a general sensibility of the times. It is, we should look at them from the perspective of the character who's making that statement. Right. So even for Arjun, he was the biggest, or I would say the greatest warrior of his time. Still, his entire life revolved around what women were doing. You know, it was his mother who decided that the wife he had the legal right to was shared with his brothers. It was his wife who decided, and you know, there was these rules that they followed that for 1 year, Draupadi was to be only with one guy, with one of the brothers. The entire year, no other brother could even come close to her. So, you know, they had set these rules. And it was because he broke that rule, because his arms were lying in Yudhishthira's chamber and Yudhishthira was with Draupadi at that time. And there was a Brahmin who came that, you know, thieves are taking away my cow or whatever. So please help me. And he entered the chamber just to pick up his arms and went out. And Yudhishthira said that it's okay. You did it for something good. So the rules don't apply. But he says, no, I broke the rules. So, and as per you, because you are the follower of Dharma and I follow you, so I will go to exile. He spent additional years in exile. Besides the 12 years, 13 years, whatever the Pandavas had done, additional to that, Arjun spent many more years in exile. So imagine, you know, when he's coming to fight the Mahabharata war, look at him from the experiences he has had, right? Mm. And what has shaped his opinion. So you never find Krishna making such statements, right? Krishna, yeah. So that clearly shows, you know, what was the highest ideal? Krishna saves Draupadi, you know, when she's being disrobed. And Krishna finds out ways to kill all these people who had, you know, actually hurt the dignity of a woman. So, I mean, I think there's just, you know, two kinds of people. One who say that, no, 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 this is all galat. This is all wrong translations. And yeah. Other side is that, see how chauvinistic they were. But it is, both of these are generalizations, which is not correct.
Yeah.
And the generalizations, they continue up until today. In fact, I know somebody over here, okay, in France, and he's married to a French woman. And when they got married, he told her, you have to touch my feet every morning. So so she came to me and said, Prachi, is this true? Is this really part of your culture? And then I asked him, I was like, what are you doing? Kya karwa rahe ho ye? So he goes like, shastro mein likha hai. So I want to know which shastra and aisa likha hai kya?
I haven't read anything like that. I don't know which shastras your friends have read. And I'll tell you one very beautiful thing, Prachi, about the shastras is that people talk about Manusmriti. People talk about, you know, these law books. So first of all, these books were never meant to be used as law books. They were guidelines for the society. Secondly, for every yuga, there was a different shastra which was to be considered. So Manusmriti was relevant only in the Satyug. In Treta, there was a different rule book. For Dwapar, there was different. And for Kali, there is a book called Parasha Smriti. And the Parasha Smriti, it is so beautifully open-minded, where it lays down the principles as, you know, society was maybe 5,000 years ago when Kaliyug began. But it says that as the times change, people should make new rules. And it says that, you know, the learned people of the land along with the king. So it specifies, it says 10 learned people sit together with the king and you create the rules.
Okay.
For the society. So if we are being adamant that no, we'll follow the rules that do not apply to our age, that is our fault. You can't believe you can't blame the shastras for that. They have clearly told you, as times change, change with the times, you know. If you want to stay stuck in, you know, like 1,000 years, 5,000 years ago, so that's your but then, you know, men in those days were also very different, right? They had a lot of responsibilities themselves. How much of that are we doing today? So, and you know, these beautiful traditions that are woven into our festivals, into our, you know, for example, Karwa Chauth, a lot of women are like, why do we have to keep fast? And, you know, why don't husbands keep fast? And this is the sad part about our traditions today, that we do not read. We do not explore what is actually written. We just believe what is being told to us. So the Purans that actually talk about these festivals, the Narad Puran actually says that Karwa Chauth is not meant for the life of your husband. It is for the woman's own life, own happiness.
Okay.
It is for her own prosperity and happiness. Saubhagya. So she, you know, over the years, as we were talking, you know, like historically things happened, society changed. It may have happened at certain point in time that the saubhagya of the woman was considered that her husband was alive, because he was the one who could save her, you know, when invasions were happening. Especially a lot of Rajput women used to keep these fasts. So when the men are going out to fight, they are fasting for their life, that, you know, my husband should return back. So imagine a tradition like that, you know, how it has been twisted to show that, you know, it was a chauvinistic society. The men are fighting for whom? For their own wives and families, right? They're not fighting just for themselves. So the women are keeping fast for their husband's lives. It's love. It's mutual appreciation.
Yeah. You know?
And now we believe that when the whole purpose is lost about, you know, it being about women's own prosperity and happiness. And secondly, it has turned into a feminist propaganda where, you know, oh, no, we will not keep it. You're not keeping it. Nobody's at loss. You are at loss because the Shastras say that you should keep it. It is for Ganpati. You are praying to Ganpati. It's a Chaturthi. Like all Chaturthis, you are supposed to pray to Ganpati and you ask Ganpati for blessings for yourself. If you are not keeping that fast, you are at loss. So, you know, that's how the... And nobody wants to know. Nobody wants to read. The people are just ready to pounce on traditions. That, why is this so? Why is this so? Boss, find out. No. What is stopping you? Everything is available online. Go read. Find out. And similarly, there is actually a fast that husbands used to keep for their wives.
Where did that go?
So Karwa Chauth was not even for the husband's life, but there was actually a fast in the Chaturmas, you know, with the 4 month period where, you know, the monsoon period, 4 months, Chaturmas, which starts with Shravan. All these 4 months, every month for one day, the husband had to fast for the long life and continued presence of his wife in his life.
Okay.
Imagine. 4 days fasting. And, you know, people don't know about it. That is why, of course, you know, it's not just the fault of, you know, a regular person, a regular Hindu today. I would say a lot of these got lost in, I mean, the priests also probably did not talk about these and did not pass on the information at some stage. But I think, you know, it is now, it is very easy to find out all these things. And really understand whether there was any such concept, whether there was an equality in the society or not, and you know, what were the traditions, all that is very easily discoverable today.
So now that we are talking about feminist propaganda, what happened with Sabarimala? Because that was something that I never understood till the end. Like women were not allowed, then they wanted women, and also what happened over there?
There are so many temples where men are not allowed.
Okay.
You know, nobody talks about it. There are temples dedicated to the goddess where men are not allowed of any age.
Okay.
Sabarimala has a restriction of women who are menstruating.
Yeah.
Younger children can go, older women can go. But there are temples dedicated to goddess where no man can go, whether a child or an old man.
Okay.
So they are traditions. They are traditions associated with those deities. You know, that there is a way to worship them. There is a shishtachar. There is a, you know, the traditions that you have to follow for that deity. Nobody's stopping you from worshiping that deity at your home. But when you have a temple, it has certain rules by which it goes, you know, which were established centuries ago. And these rules are for the preservation of the essence of that deity. You know, that deity, Ayappa, is actually he's a brahmachari. Right? So a lot of people also say that girls should not pray to Hanuman.
Yeah.
Because he's a brahmachari. But everybody prays to everybody prays to Hanuman.
Prays to Hanuman. Right?
Yeah. So because there is no such rules anywhere. No temple says that you can't go and pray to Hanuman. But when there is a certain temple where the deity is established and there were rules laid out for it, you should respect those rules. That's the only thing. It's again, I would say it's an issue that has been, it's misrepresented because it's not about women. It's about menstruating women not being allowed because the deity is a brahmachari. And in terms of his own penance, his own, I don't know what, you know, prompted the rules, but he being a brahmachari is the only reason why women of childbearing age are not allowed. Again, a lot of people look at it that, you know, women are prohibited. So it's against women. No. A lot of times it is also for the protection of women. You know, where these energies are so dominant, where the masculine energy is so dominant, and you know, when you are going through a period, you're physiologically in a weak state, you're mentally in a weak state, physically in a weak state. At that time, that was the belief that women, and that is the reason why women who were having periods were not allowed to come into the kitchen or not allowed to do work. It was an excuse to give them a
to
holiday.
Take them. Yeah,
they give them a holiday, boss, you just rest. Okay.
And now we are fighting for that.
Yeah. Because it was built into the traditions, otherwise no one would allow a woman to rest. Right? Mm. No one would allow her to take 4 days, 5 days off every month. But, so this was a way to tie it up into the traditions. I think that is the same concept in Sabarimala, that, women of when they are in that physiological state, they are also more susceptible to those energies that are present. And we do not believe it's just a stone statue, stone idol, right? It is a god, it is a deity, where, Pran Pratishtha was done by Parshuram himself. So it's a very powerful place and you do not want to mess with it. It is just stupid that the way, things are going. And nobody will talk about the restrictions on men. and men are okay. men are okay. It's okay.
So which are these temples where men are not allowed?
There's a lot of temples related to Shaktism, related to Tantra, where certain forms of the goddess are worshipped in a certain way, where in a lot of temples at certain times men are not allowed. In other temples, men are never allowed to enter. These are the forms where only the goddess remains with her associates who are all female, and only female priests, female devotees are allowed. So, that's again the beauty that, there's no fight for supremacy here. It's just about different people following their own traditions.
Yes.
So if you have to tell the younger generation to start learning about these things, because you say nobody reads, because there's so much to read, what can they read? Where should they start from?
It's very easy, actually. There's a lot. I know a lot of people get confused, but first of all, you need to understand what is there and what scripture, right? Mm-hmm. So, for example, for Christianity, you just read the Bible and you get to know the concepts.
Yeah.
Or, you read the Quran, you get to know about Islam, But for Hinduism, because it's been around for thousands of years, the rishis, the sages, they created different kind of texts for different kind of people. So for intellectuals, you go and read a Ved, you read the Upanishad. For people who love stories or who want to understand through stories, you read the Ramayana, the Mahabharata or the Purans. People who want to read philosophy, the metaphysics, you read the Bhagavad Gita, which is again a summary of the Upanishads. So the sages, in their wisdom, they realized that everybody cannot have the same IQ, they cannot have the same bent of mind, and you cannot have the same scripture applying to all. So you have the same principles that are meant to be followed by all, but they are told to people in different ways. It's either through stories, it's either through mantras, it's either through meditation. So you are free to follow Karma Yoga, the Jnana Yoga, the Bhakti Yoga. You do the Hatha Yoga, you do the Yogasans. Whichever way you feel, if you're a physical person, you want to do that. But the idea is to connect the Atman to the Brahman.
Yeah.
And whatever way works for you, you pick that. So when you want to read the books, first you analyze what is your bent of mind. What do you want to know? Do you want to know about our history? Do you want to know about our stories? Do you want to know about legends? Do you want to know the principles? So that is how you decide what book to pick. And to simplify, I would say Vedas may or may not be very relevant for a person who's not into rituals, but they are very informative in terms of our history, in terms of our practices, in terms of our beliefs in the elemental gods. They also tell us about the geography, about the culture, about the traditions, about the respect for different deities, both male and female. They are the foundations of our religion. But if you want to know the stories, Ramayana, Mahabharata, a lot of people think they know, but they don't know. because they've only watched them on in the TV serials, which are completely distorted, and they do not really know. Mahabharata itself is huge. It's massive. You cannot know everything in it. And the Purans, I would say, I would always suggest, you know, Vishnu Puran is one of the most simple and very clear and lucid Puran to read.
Okay.
So that helps you understand the various concepts of creation, of the different genealogies, the Surya Vansh, the Chandra Vansh, the great kings that were there in our past, and the stories of gods and demons. So Vishnu Puran, and I generally suggest people that, you know, if you have read one Puran, read at least three, because, you know, the Purans have a supreme deity in each of these Purans. So Vishnu Puran is primarily dedicated to Lord Vishnu. And Shiv Puran, Ling Puran, Skand Puran are primarily dedicated to Shiva. Similarly, Devi Puran, Devi Bhagavat Puran are for Shakti. So for a holistic understanding, you should read at least one for each.
Okay.
And they have beautiful stories in them. Amazing stories. If you love stories, you know, you will be flabbergasted, you know, by the extent of imagination, the extent of, you know, the concepts that have been put down in those Purans. So that's how you go about choosing a book. Everything is available online. There's a lot of websites available that have the translations, authentic translations on these. And I've actually earlier done a video also on it, which is available on my YouTube channel, which has all the links to these websites in the description. So if you want to read a book, you can always order through Amazon. There's so many translations available. Bhagavad Gita itself has been translated into all the world languages. So, and I suggest, do not read a commentary by anyone.
Yeah.
Read plain translations.
Yes.
Or even if you pick up a commentary, skip the commentary part. Just read the translations. Yeah. That's how you build your foundation.
Yeah.
And then you can go deeper into it.
But it's also okay to not agree with everything that's in these books, right? Because sometimes I justify saying that religion, whatever religion, was in the end created by humans. So, of course, there are things that are not 100% right. Of course, there are things that are biased and, like you said, reflecting of the times. So it's perfectly all right if you don't agree with everything, because there can be mistakes.
Of course, of course. And see, it's been thousands of years that these books have been passed down. You cannot ignore the possibility of interpolations or changes happening.
Yes.
But the only Vedas we consider have been unchanged, because, you know, they have been passed down through oral tradition. And it is not possible to remember an entire Ved and still make mistakes while reciting it, because it was done every single day. Every morning, the students, the pupils were supposed to recite whatever they were being taught. So the Vedas have been passed unchanged, but there's always a possibility of, you know, some changes might have happened over the years in the other scriptures. But again, as you said, you do not have to agree with everything. You understand the concept. Stop looking at everything from, you know, wearing 21st century glasses.
Yeah.
You think of the times that they were written. It was 5,000 years ago that Mahabharata war was fought. You imagine what were the civilizations existing at that time. You know, there was only the Egyptians, there were probably Chinese coming up, and there was, you know, the Sumerians, Mesopotamians. What was the society at that time? And, you know, you imagine that society, and then you judge, you know, what you feel is right or not right. But again, I think it's the concepts, it's the learnings, it's the lessons that are important, rather than getting into debates about historicity, about authenticity, about whatever. They're all meant to convey some messages and some, you know, profound truths about our understanding of this universe. There's so many scientific things mentioned in the Purans. You know, you're taken aback when you read something. You're like, oh my God, what was this? And and you realize, because now science is advanced enough for us to understand. Maybe in the Britishers' time, the science was not advanced. They thought these were stories. Had science actually been advanced, they would have been surprised to see all these scientific things mentioned in the books.
Yeah.
But now, with today's technology, we can understand what they're talking about. And then you feel surprised. How could this have happened thousands of years ago? How did they have that technology? So that's a different question altogether. But you realize there's a lot of science also hidden in it. So I just, you know, want people to read, explore. Don't take my word for it. Don't take anyone's word for it. Just go and start reading. Do not read someone's translations, someone, in the sense, someone's interpretations of it, that I feel this is what is written. No. You read, you decide for yourself what is written, what is meant by it. And don't be too quick to judge. Think of the character. As I said, you know, Bhishma Pitama or Chanakya, you know, they were, what times they were living in, what was their own journey and why they said what they said. At the same time, there are beautifully balanced nuances, you know, that you see from other characters as well. So don't generalize, don't be in a rush to denigrate your culture or your history just because you, that is more fashionable today. That's all.
So another thing, another huge misunderstanding that automatically comes with Hinduism is the caste system. And even in our day and time, I've seen priests themselves explaining Brahmins come from the head and then somebody from the shoulders, from the thighs, from the feet. So how will you explain this?
Of course, you know, there are verses that say that Brahmins come from the mouth. The Kshatriyas come from the limbs, from the arms. The Vaishyas come from the thighs and the Shudras come from the feet. But do you think your feet are less important than your body, than your arms?
Or than the mouth?
They are, every single limb, every single part of your body is equally important.
Yeah.
So why do we feel offended if we say that, you know, somebody's come from the feet or somebody's come from the thighs? You know, that is just a way to show that the foundation of a society is by the Shudras. Who were the Shudras? They were the servants, they were the domestic help, they were the janitors, they were the people who were maintaining the hygiene. The basic hygiene of the civilization goes for a toss if there's nobody to clean it up. Right?
Yeah.
What happened in COVID? Everybody became a Shudra, right? We were all doing everything.
Yeah.
Did you become a lesser person because of that? No. Yeah. That was an integral part of life. And similarly, for society, there are this is division of labor. In every society, you will have intellectuals, you will have warriors, you will have traders, and you will have people who are in the labor jobs.
Yeah.
So there's nothing to be offended about it. Caste system is basically division of labor. Where it becomes problematic is when you tie it to birth.
Yeah.
But that is not the origin of the caste system. Caste itself does not, caste is not an Indian word. It's a Spanish or Portuguese word. It does not find mention in any of our, we call it Varn. And Varn means your profession. So it comes from your profession. It does not come from your birth. Of course, when you make it birth-based, that will create problems. When you tie people to their own profession only, that you are a Brahmin. But there's reverse caste system that's happening, right? What is nepotism? When we talk about Bollywood nepotism, we talk about nepotism in leadership, in politicians. Isn't that a sort of a caste system that is happening?
Yeah.
But nepotism also, I feel, is something very natural, no? Like, you would want your kid to go in the same field as you are.
Exactly. So that's why I'm saying that, you know, over hundreds of years, it probably got more crystallized into the a rigid caste, birth-based caste system. But that is not what caste system means. It is only a division of labor. That is it. In fact, there are verses which say that everybody is born a Shudra. It is by your sanskars, by your training, by your education that you find your true caste. There is there is a verse in the Rig Veda where the, you know, where that young rishi is actually talking about his mother, being an agriculturist, his father being something else, and, you know, he is himself a singer. So in the same family, you find these three different professions that were existing. So how can you say that, you know, it was birth-based? So I think that is where people are very quick to judge. People are very quick to misrepresent. It serves a political agenda also by, showing Hinduism as a very rigid caste based and atrocity committing religion, and most of the people outside of India, that's all they know about Hinduism. It's that you worship cows, you have caste system, that's about it. Nobody knows about the philosophies, that the scientific concepts, the entire concept of mathematics as it exists today has come from India. Why don't you talk? There's no balanced representation of Hinduism, unfortunately. And it serves a political purpose, I would say. It serves the left-dominated, so-called liberal agenda. But it is false. It is flawed. If you open any of your texts, you see, you read, and don't pick selectively. Oh, no, but this text says this. But there's 100 other texts that don't say that or who counter that. So if you want to be selective, you want to pick only one aspect, you will find text of all sorts in any world religion. So I think it's up to us, especially, us and you Indians living abroad, spreading the right information, right knowledge, first amongst the Indians who are there.
Yeah.
And of course, sharing it with others. Like when I travel, I meet so many people of different nationalities, and I always make it a point to explain to them, what if there's a conversation around it, that, what the basic belief of Hinduism is in one God. A lot of, Muslims are told, a lot of Christians are told that Hinduism is, they believe that, we believe in multiple gods. So that is why they call us kafir. So imagine there's so much hatred being spread in the world today because of misrepresentation that is not even existing in our texts. So I think it's about time we start doing something about it. So great that you have also started this initiative, and I'm happy that, you're doing this, and I hope it reaches a lot of people around you, and they are forced to think or, relook at their own traditions and culture and beliefs and find out more about them.
So, because like we are talking about science and how evolved India was and everything, what is happening right now at this very moment is the Mahakumbh Mela. Can you tell us about that?
So the Mahakumbh actually reflects, it's a 12-year cycle where there's four sites in India, and basis the astronomical positions of Sun and the Jupiter, which happens in 12 years because Jupiter has a 12-year revolution around the Sun. So their relative positions change every 12 years. I mean, they keep changing, but they come back to the same position every 12 years. So every 12 years you have a Kumbh. And it happens, at the confluence of rivers, where there's multiple rivers joining the Sangam. So Prayagraj, for example, is a Sangam. And where there's water flowing, fresh water flowing. And this happens in a season when winter is going out and, summer is coming in or spring is coming in. And people are encouraged to go out and, take a dip in the fresh waters, because imagine what happens in winters. And there was a very interesting walk that I did in London. It was a walking tour of London city, and there was the guide, she told us that the Britishers in winters, they would take baths, and I don't remember exactly, but once in a month, and because there was scarcity of fresh water. And water would be heated up and filled up in a bathtub, and the master of the house, the man, will take a bath in that water. Since there is no more water, the woman would go in next in the same water. And then the children will be bathed in that same very water. Okay? That is what used to happen in these temperate countries that did not have fresh water. We have fresh flowing water, rivers, a climate where you can take a dip into the river any time of the year, most of the times of the year. And that is why it was always encouraged to take a dip in fresh water, cleanse yourself. It is about cleaning. It's about mental, spiritual, physical cleaning. It's also about coming together of people. In a Mahakumbh, there are people who are coming from all across the country. different corners of the world, I would say. People are getting together, ideas are exchanged. You know, there's so these are the centers, these were the places where, you know, spiritual exchanges happened. There were people who would meet each other after years. You know, it was not easy to travel in olden days. And I remember there was a question somebody asked me that why did Krishna ever meet Radha again? And you actually find the mention of that, I think, in Bhagavad Puran or in Mahabharata, where there is a eclipse that happens in Kurukshetra. And during eclipses, you're supposed to take a bath in the waters. And for that eclipse, the eclipse was predicted. So Krishna and his entourage, they traveled from Dwarka to Kurukshetra. And from Mathura and Vrindavan also, the Gwalas, the Yadavs had come. And that is when Krishna actually meets his family again. The gopis and his family again. So it was not easy to travel all the time, you know, right? So these events became the places where people could meet each other, could exchange ideas, they could learn from each other, they could talk about spirituality, they could talk about rituals, they could, you know, the Ganga Aarti itself is such a powerful ritual. If you are a part of it, you feel a certain vibe, you know, and you're respecting nature, you're worshipping the rivers as goddesses. You are basically sanctifying nature, and you strengthen that concept with all these activities. So I think beyond the rituals, beyond the, you know, build up and beyond the marketing campaigns, I think it's basically a time to spiritually enrich yourself. And of course, you know, travel to a place that you have never been to probably, and you know, explore your country in a in a better way. So I definitely suggest, you know, some such trips at least once in a life should be taken. And, you know, attend one of these congregations. It does not have necessarily have to be the Mahakumbh. It could be anywhere, wherever it is convenient for you to travel. But attend some congregations, some gatherings, listen to some preachers, listen to what they have to say, talk to the people around you, exchange ideas, know about them, know about their beliefs. And there's so much, so much. You are enriched with all these interactions. And just the fact that, you know, physically you're getting out of your comfort zone and going to a place that you probably would not have planned for otherwise, I think that itself enriches you in ways that you don't even realize.
Yeah, that's true.
So in this conversation, many times we've spoken about the different yugas. And so Mahabharata was a different yuga, as far as my understanding goes. But then you say it was 5,000 years ago. So we're talking about a continuous civilization. Can you explain what is a yuga? And when it ends, they say it's not the earth that's ending, basically.
So
no, of course not. I think that's another misunderstanding. People believe that when a yuga changes, the pralaya happens and everything is gets destroyed. No, that's completely untrue. There is a cycle of yugas. There's Chaturyuga cycle, the Satyug, Treta, Dwapar and Kali. And after Kali again, Satyug, Treta, Dwapar, Kali. So that's the cycle that continues. And this continues for 71 Mahayugs, 71 cycles. And after that is called, so 71 Mahayugs is called one Manvantar. And after and there are such 14 Manvantars in one day of Brahma. So after that day of Brahma, when the night of Brahma comes, that is when actually pralaya happens.
Okay.
It does not happen after every yuga. It does not happen after every Mahayuga. It does not happen after Manvantar. It happens at the end of a kalpa, which is when the night of Brahma emerges. So in Purans, you have clear mentions of, you know, stuff like this. It's all it's very mathematically detailed. And unfortunately, nobody reads. So we keep living with all these misconceptions. So it's not. So it's a continuous civilization, of course. And so Kaliyug is supposed to have begun in 3102 BC. That is the calculation of Aryabhatta, who was one of the most accomplished mathematicians in ancient India. And accordingly, Mahabharata War is said to have happened 36 years before the Kaliyug began. So
okay.
about 3138 BC, the Mahabharata war would have happened. But that was a previous yug. That was the Dwapar yug ending. And then
okay.
Kaliyug began after 36 years of the war.
And then, now you're sure that when this ends, this is not the last yuga. It's not the...
Of course not. We are only in the... We are in the 28th cycle of this Manvantar. This
okay.
is, our plans are very clear. They tell us where we are, when we are. And
okay.
they tell us that this is, so this is the 51st year of our Brahma, whose life is 100 years. This is the first day or first kalp of the 51st year of our Brahma. And this is the seventh Manvantar that is going on. We are in the afternoon of that day.
Okay. Okay.
Because out of 14, this is the 7th Manvantar. And out of the 71 Mahayuga cycles in each Manvantar, we are in the 28th. There's
okay.
a long way to go for Pralaya to happen.
And for Kaliyug to end, how much more time to go?
So according to our Purans, it's the Kaliyug is supposed to be 432,000 years long.
Okay.
Yeah, but there are different opinions about it. People have different views about it. Unfortunately, I haven't gone too deep into it about, you know, what could be the numbers. But according to our Purans, there's a long time to go.
Thank you so much. This has been really enlightening and fun at the same time. Very educational. So thank you so much. And thank you for encouraging all of us to read and find out more.
So thank you.
My pleasure. My pleasure completely. And again, I would reiterate that message again. For you and for your audience as well, pick up any text. They're all available online. Just start reading. Just pick up, you know, Vishnu Puran online or the Shiv Puran or the Devi Bhagavat Puran or the Bhagavad Gita. Start reading. Once you get into that world, you will start understanding it better. Don't try to understand it from the outsider's perspective. We are all outsiders right now. We are not practicing the religion which is mentioned in the scriptures. So when you start reading, that is when you realize, when you actually get in touch with the soul of the religion. And that is when you will understand what it all means. So till then, happy exploring.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for your time and wisdom.
My pleasure.